This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
The Word Festival for 2018 featured a pop-up festival in New Regent Street, and Plains FM was there to record the science fiction series. The following recording features readings from several well-known local and international writers.
Hello. Thank you everyone for coming to this science fiction triple feature at the New Regent Street pop-up festival. I'm your host, AJ Fitzwater. I'll be reading in the second third set. But with us today, we also have Juno Dawson, who will be reading in the first set. And we also have Karen Healy. So we're going to start off first with Juno Dawson. So put your hands together for Juno Dawson, please.
So I was like a last-minute addition to the science fiction, speculative fiction gang. And I'm going to do an exclusive reading of my Doctor Who novel, which comes out in October. I'm very lucky in that I'm the first author to write for Jodie Whittaker's 13th Doctor, which is cool. And obviously we're both from Yorkshire, so it just couldn't be more perfect. My book is called The Good Doctor. On the tank's monitor, General Oryx surveyed the ruins with keen yellow eyes. Kanda was once a proud, beautiful city. Now it was little more than rubble, only the charred skeletons of homes, temples and shops still stood. By dawn, the war would be over, and the Loba would reclaim their world. Lobos for Loba, she often told her troops. Kanda was the last stronghold of the rebels, and Oryx had them surrounded. The tank bumped and shuddered as it ploughed over the debris. Hers was one of a fleet all closing in on the city. For the human scum, there would be no escape. General Oryx, said Captain Brunn, incoming from above. Oryx checked her radar, and sure enough, a small flying object, a drone of some sort perhaps, approached. What is that thing? Intercepted, blasted out of the sky. There was only room for two personnel in the tank, but they were flanked by hundreds of foot soldiers, ready to storm what was left of Kanda Plaza on her command. Stop! The voice boomed from every speaker in the tank. Oryx covered her ears and Brunn yanked the headphones off his head. The tank stopped rolling, its engines dead. The few lanterns that still worked on the street flickered and went out. Even her scanners dimmed until the auxiliary batteries kicked in. Who is that? Where is it coming from? Oryx snarled, her eyes almost glowing in the gloom of the tank. Why did you stop? I didn't, General. The controls are frozen. It won't move. Where are the floodlights? Get me visual. All she could assume was that the humans had somehow got their furless paws on alien technology. And destroy that drone now! Weapons offline, ma'am. Oryx's heart pounded. This wasn't possible. The rebels didn't have the means to. It's me. Please, ceasefire. Oryx recognized that voice well. General, Brunn said quietly. It sounds like... Stop the assault now, halt! She spoke into the comm system. Fleet, halt and ceasefire. That's an order, over. The tank had enough power for her to use the visualizer. Oryx scanned the district. In the east, the suns were starting to rise, the sky almost violet-purple. With the tanks and bikes now still, the dust started to settle on Kanda Plaza. In the sky, a single light shone from a spherical drone. It hovered like it was waiting for her to make a move. What is that? Oryx growled. Negative, General. The scanner doesn't recognize the technology as human. Is it a weapon? I don't know. Mother! His voice once more blasted all around them. Please, can we talk? There was a flurry of movement on the deserted street. A drain cover popped up and rolled across the street and came to a stop with a clang. Hold fire, Oryx commanded, trying to keep panic out of her voice. But train your guns on that drain. Someone's coming out, Brun told her. A makeshift white flag emerged from the sewer. It appeared to be an article of clothing, a cotton shirt with the words Frankie Says Relax in black human script attached to a bamboo cane. "They're surrendering," Brun whispered. "We won." "Wait here, unseal the hatch." "But General, they may have gas bombs or poison or..." "Do it!" With a hiss, the hatch unlocked. Oryx twisted the handle and swung the door open. The air was gritty and dusty, tinged with acrid smoke and gunpowder. She pulled her scarf over her snout and mouth. From the drain, she saw Avi emerge holding his flag. It took everything she had not to cry out and run to him. She had long since thought her son dead. And there he was, alive. As Avi crawled out into the rubble, he was followed by a human woman. She had yellow head fur and wore a long beige coat. She didn't look like a soldier at all. Her trousers finished halfway up her legs, for one thing. She too stumbled onto the plaza, her arms aloft in surrender. Behind her came an elderly human male and a face she recognised all too well, Alex Blaine, the human resistance leader. Faintly, she heard snipers ready their weapons. Her soldiers had them entirely covered on all sides. "I said hold your fire or I will have your pelts," she yelled. She would not risk her only son, not now that she had the second chance. How was this even possible? Oryx slid over the front of the tank and dropped down into the debris. She established that Blaine didn't appear to be holding a gun, but that meant nothing. He'd killed many, many Lober in his time. "Mother," Avi began. Oryx said nothing because she didn't trust herself not to cry, and that would be unforgivable in front of her troops. Her cub was fully grown now, taller than her. They were unmistakably mother and cub, however. Same eyes, same thick, shaggy chestnut fur. "Mother, I..." Suddenly the human woman interrupted him, stepping between them. Up close, she was slight, impish. "I'm sorry, but would you look at the state of this?" She twirled around, waving her arms at the ruins. "Look at all this mess." As she spun closer, Oryx drew her gun. "Stay where you are, freeze." "But look at all this mess," the woman said again, her eyes wide. Oryx wondered if maybe she was intoxicated. "I won't warn you again, human. Look at it." This time it was a demand. The human woman, somehow, was almost nose to nose with her. "What do you mean?" "Just what I said. Look at this mess." She snorted. For the first time, Oryx looked at her feet. Scattered around her gleaming boots was all sorts of junk from the old marketplace. The woman with yellow fur squatted down for a split second and bounced back up, holding a chipped mug. "Look." Oryx sighed. She didn't have time for this. "It's a cup." "It's a blue cup." "I see that." "Probably belongs to someone, don't you think?" She pointed at the ruins. "From one of those homes, I should think. I wonder if it was someone's favourite mug. I wonder if every morning, without fail, they'd wake up and make a lovely cup of tea in their favourite blue mug. I can't start the day without a cup of tea in my favourite mug. Can you?" "What?" "I like Yorkshire tea the best. What about you?" She kicked through the rubble. Her hand shot out like a dart and this time seized a photo frame. "I've always had a soft spot for a photo frame," she said. "Especially after the 20th century when everything went digital. Because to print out a photo and put it in a frame, you really, really had to care about who was in that picture, right?" She rubbed the shattered glass with her cuff. "I wonder who they were. I mean, if this is half buried, they're dead, right?" She tossed the photo at Oryx's feet. "Lober family, by the way, if that makes a difference. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe that's the picture that came with the frame." "Who are you? Explain yourself," Oryx demanded. "Mother, listen to her," Avi urged. "I've seen so many wars," the woman said, still pacing in the dirt, kicking up dust. "And if there's one thing I know to be absolutely universally true, it's this. If you stop and look in the rubble for about 60 seconds, you'll find this. Almost out of thin air, the woman produced a filthy stuffed animal. A teddy bear with one eye. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Juno, for taking time to come and read for us. Thank you. So next up we have Karen Healy. She was recently, she undertook the Ursula Bethel residency at Canterbury University. She has a collection of three short stories, What We Reach For, currently available on Amazon. So please welcome Karen Healy.
I do have short stories out and I just put them on sale in honour of Word. But I'm primarily a novelist, which means that when I write sci-fi, I tend to disguise it as something else. So this is an extract from a novella that hopefully will be coming out next year. This is a sneak peek for you. And it's called Beauty, for reasons that will become obvious. I promise it is sci-fi, but you'll only really get that if you stick around for the second session. I do not know how it is in your countries, but in mine there is plenty of reason to fear the ghoulings who ride the howling winds, seeking a body for their shrunken spirits. Ghoulings are creatures of air and breath, listening to every word stolen by the wind, and so the people of my country do not name their children until their seventh birthday. Naming is a perilous act, quite the most dangerous between birth and childbearing, and the one to be named is kept awake all night by clamour of bells and deep drumming and harsh words until the first light is over our grey hills. Then the child's parents tell the people their child's name. In other lands, I have heard, a name can be something held close to a person's self. One might name a woodcutter Sawyer, or the Lord Secretary Clark. At birth, one might call a child Grace or Honour, seeking to instil that quality. In my hometown of Amberley and the other places of my country, we name a child as far from itself as we can. A kind child might be named Malice or a braggart Humble. A child who anticipates the worst could be Hope, and a child who sings all the day might be Doleful. Thus it was that on my seventh birthday, I was named Beauty. It would have been a true name had I not fallen into the fire shortly after my sixth birthday. I do not remember the falling, only the pain and the long time I stayed in bed, dreaming in and out of myself with my left cheek burning. I recovered in time and kept my left eye, though the skin was pulled tight across it, and I never saw as well. My left hand was usable, but much weaker than my right. My hair had caught at once, and most of it burned away before my mother could roll me in the snow. It grew back on the right side and at the back, as black and straight as it had been before, but on the left it grew in patches and sometimes through and around the scars on my face and scalp, which looked like thick runnels of candle wax. I cried when they named me Beauty, and it was not out of vanity, as my sister Kindness said. They could have called me Dutiful, because I sometimes dawdled in my chores, or Nimble, because I often bumped into things, and I would not have cried then. I did not blame my parents for seeing that I was ugly. I cried because it came to me for the first time that for the rest of my life many would see nothing else. It was not unusual for children who had received a name they did not relish to attempt to change, not in their name, but in themselves. Though my sister Kindness never smoothed her rough tongue, my friend Verity gradually gave up her habit of telling fantastical stories and insisting they were true, and her twin brother Lightfoot, who had previously preferred books to the outdoors, practiced running and wrestling until he was stronger and faster than any other in the village. My particular rebellion was not an attempt to become more beautiful. After all, how could I? But an effort to be known for something other than the spectacle of my face. This impulse finally manifested in ever more dangerous feats of daring. I climbed the highest trees and took the longest leaps from the grey rocks into the swimming hole. I ran through the bull's paddock and ate anything my age mates brought me that wasn't actually poison. Most impressive of all, I walked past the boneyard whistling, a clear taunt to any ghoulings who might be lingering around the dead. Pushing my body to its limits meant that I learned to trust my own strength and quickness, learned what I could and could not do with my weak left hand and how to use my right to compensate. I was injured several times and this was certainly unpleasant, but it confirmed what I had learned, that I could feel pain and survive it and go on. By my 13th year, I was helping Father rethatch the roof, balancing without fear on the ridgepole. By my 15th year, I was the one called if they needed help at the smithy, clinging with my strong right hand to the halter of a vicious horse. And by my 17th year, I made regular journeys into the haunted woods that edged Amberley to collect greens. That was a hard winter, and our own gardens were covered. But snow would not kill the plants that grew wild under those whispering trees. The castle of the magician beast lay in the forest. It was deep within, far further than even I would go, but his influence could still be felt at the edges, with shadows that were longer than they should be and whispers on still days that could not be caused by the wind. The magician beast had powerful, unpredictable magic and was not to be crossed or even approached. Amberley, tucked tight against the edges of his forest, felt his strength. But if we feared him, we were also grateful. In other towns, people feared that the souls of their families would be snatched away, their bodies grotesquely possessed until they fell apart under the strain. In Amberley, we observed the naming ceremonies and kept close watch on our people who were sick and vulnerable, and we felt the added protection of the magician beast at our backs. It had been many years since one of us was taken, and that only once they had left the bounds of Amberley. It was one of the reasons we so rarely left, especially in the short, dim days of winter, when the ghouling wind might come at any time. On one cold winter's day, I climbed down from the sleeping loft in the grey pre-dawn light while my sisters curled closer together under their mound of quilts. Quiet as I was, Father had been quieter. I stepped outside to find him in whispered conversation with our neighbour Attentive, as both hoisted laden saddlebags onto Attentive's horse. "You're not trading," I said, far too loud.
I always tend to disguise my sci-fi as something that isn't. So When We Wake is a Sleeping Beauty dystopia. This is something else. So Beauty's father has been possessed by something called a ghouling. She found a rose bush in the forest and she is going after it because she thinks it might be able to heal him. My feet knew the way and I trusted them. Trusted my eyes and arms to send me through gaps and fend away branches that might snag at cloak or skin. I flew on, my hair lifting as I leapt over deadfall and dodged boulders and did not stop to breathe or think until I had reached the glade with the ferns and the stream and the roses that bloomed in winter. I fell to my knees before the white rose bush and breathed in. I barely had time to notice the ache in my side, the scratched arms and stubbed toes before they vanished, soothed away by the rose's scent. "I'm sorry," I told the bush and reached for the knife in my belt. I would have to take it out by the roots if Father were to have any chance at all. The moment my knife touched the soil, the noise came. It was a great concussion of violent air and thundering sound. So huge it knocked me onto my back, so loud that my head rang and my eyes watered. I lay there, too stunned to muster fear, when the large form stooped over me. He picked me up as easily as I might lift a newborn kitten, and my legs were near as weak as one, so that when he set me on my feet,
I felt my thighs quiver and had to lock my knees to stay upright. Unthinking, I leaned into him for support and felt the heat of him and smelt the spicy scent of his furry hide before sense returned in a horrified rush and I leapt backwards, bracing myself against a tree. I am counted medium height for a woman, and he was taller than the tallest man in our village, taller by at least two heads. His bared shoulders were wider than the blacksmith's, and they tapered to narrow hips, wrapped in a length of some blue fabric I did not recognize. His feet were long and bare, but for the yellow-brown fur, with three toes before and two back. The claws on his furred hands were retracted, but I saw where they would be when they emerged and shuddered and raised my eyes to his face and went still. The fur hair was shorter. He looked something like a cat and something like a man, with a short nose and wide brow and high cheekbones that narrowed to a pointed chin. His pupils were black as the ghoulings were white, and around each wide pupil was a thin iris of gold which blazed at me from his face. He saw me looking and smiled, and the white teeth flashed. His upper canines were long and sharp, and when he closed his mouth again, I could see their tips resting on his lower lip. Where the magician beast had touched me, on my left shoulder and my right upper arm, it felt as if he had touched my bare flesh, and my face was as warm as if I had been working by the fire. "Lord," I said, and stopped when he shook his head. His great mane, the orange-red of falling leaves, shifted about his shoulders. "I did not take you for a thief," he said. "Why did you try to dig out the rose?" "A ghouling took my father," I said, my voice gone hoarse and thin. I gaped at him. "A ghouling? The wind demons, the body stealers. They ride the wind and people breathe them in and they take the body and use it until it falls." "Ah," the beast said, "the Ishkthili." I didn't care what he named them, only that from the way he spoke he knew them and felt no kindness for them. "Yes," I said, "it took my father, but we caught it, my sisters and I, and tied it up. Ghoulings don't come into the forest, and I knew the roses could be nothing of theirs. I thought the roses have many virtues, but they cannot banish an Ishkthili," he said. "You would have stolen them for nothing." It was hard to read human emotion in those golden eyes, but I thought he was watching me. "Can you banish the Ishkthili?" "Yes," I said. "One of them, trapped and vulnerable, yes, that should still lie within my power." "Will you?" He didn't answer immediately. He leaned over the bush and inhaled and stalked the edge of the clearing. I caught his scent again as he moved upwind. "I would have to leave these woods," he said. "I would expose myself to attack. Such work demands a price. What would you pay?" I thought of the riches of our house, kindnesses knitting and stumbles weaving. The horse sluggard, if he was still alive. My sisters would give all of these gladly, I knew, and yet even to offer them seemed an insult. We could give over the secrets of our family patterns, and those would be worth much in the wider world, but I could not tell if the beast would think so. The fabric around his hips was smooth and shiny, with no weave or knit that I could see. Better, I thought, to let him set the price. "I would pay anything within my gift," I said, and was proud that my voice did not tremble. He took a step closer. "Even yourself?" he asked, watching me with golden eyes. "If what I requested was your presence in my home, would you still consent? If I save your father, will you come away from your family and all you have known and live and share with me?" "Yes," I said. "If you save my father, I will live with you."
Thank you. I like writing science fiction that is disguised as something else, usually a fairy tale. So this is teacher face. This is teachers. This is a Beauty and the Beast retelling, where Beauty's father has been possessed by a nasty thing, and she went and begged the assistance of the magician Beast, who turned up and did some stuff with a device that she doesn't recognise. And the price for his assistance is that Beauty will come and live with him. So the rescue has taken place, the village is in celebration, and here we go. "If you'll excuse me, madam," the Beast said in his soft voice, "the bargain must be kept." He had crept to join my sisters and I in the twilight. Kindness put her hands on her hips, and Stumble leaned forward, her eyes huge and pleading. "Well, don't," I said, and jumped to my feet. "I can't bear it. I don't want to argue. I said I would go, and I must." I could not stand the thought of going home, even to pack anything. And if I hugged Father one more time, I might try to stay and break my bargain. And that, I knew, would be not only dishonourable, but dangerous. "I love you," I told my sisters through the tears that blurred my vision, and reached out blindly for the Beast. He caught up my hand in his great one. "Can we leave? Now?" "As you wish, Beauty," he said, and the world dissolved around us again. That time we were in the place of cold fire and bright sparks and darkness for much longer, and when we came out, I was no place I had ever seen. If I had thought about the castle of the magician Beast, I had thought in terms of things I knew. A great home of stone and wood, like the biggest house in Greenroot, only more so. Perhaps glass windows and rich tapestries. Perhaps carved furnishings and respectful servants. This was not that. We were in a large room. It was round, which was strange, and there were high stools around a table in the centre. There was something that looked like a window or a mirror, only it was dark and suspended from the ceiling, not against a wall. The floor was not wood or dirt or tile, but some pale substance that gave a little under my boots. The Beast's feet splayed and flexed, and I saw that he was comfortable on that surface. "I normally wear shoes outside," he said. "Of course," I said inanely, "but I saw you go to dig out the rosebush and left without them." "I'm sorry," I said. "I wouldn't have touched it, you know, if it hadn't been..." "I understand. I might have done the same if I thought it could help my father. My mother planted the roses in his memory." He was trying to share with me something I could see, some connection that might bind us, but when he mentioned his mother, I could not imagine her, could not think what the Beast's mother would look like. I thought only of mine and was very tired. "Where do I sleep?" I asked, and then flushed the roots of my hair. What would I do if he said, "with me"? He had said I would live with him. He had not said for how long or what that would entail. I was not a complete innocent. Verity had kissed me in her mother's house, and I'd liked that, and Lightfoot and I had walked out together a few times, which was a fine way to say we had tucked ourselves into a hayloft and giggled and touched each other. But he was so strange. I did not know how it would be with him. I did not know if I wanted to try. "Oh," he said and looked around. "You can... home?" "Yes, Lieutenant." The voice came from the air and I jumped, but the Beast continued. "I have a guest." "I can see that," the voice said. "She will need quarters, private quarters. I mean, I shall restrict in-room surveillance to vital life signs only," the cool voice said. I couldn't tell if it belonged to someone like me or someone like the Beast or something else altogether. There was no accent and I understood the words, which seemed strange in itself. The Beast made that shape with his mouth that I thought meant relief. "Thank you. Beauty, home will guide you to your room." A section of the wall lighted, a warm glow as if it were lit from behind with many candles. "This way, please," said the cool voice of home, and having no other choice, I walked towards the wall. A few paces before I would have walked into the lit place, it slid to the side, revealing a corridor.
This was a magician's castle, I reminded myself, and his magic had saved my father. I walked through with my chin raised and my eyes steady. The being called home lighted the way for me and opened more invisible doors as I walked. I saw no one of either the beast kind or my own. Curious, I tried walking towards an unlit area only once. The wall turned red. That area is currently restricted. Please follow the path. My room, when I came to it, was white and narrow. The ceiling was high to accommodate people of the beast's height, and the bed was long, but the furniture, a table under the bed loft with a single stool, a shelf and set of drawers set into the wall, crowded most of the floor. And this is home, I muttered. Yes, said home, and I startled, cracking my elbow against a strange glassed-in box. Are you here? I am everywhere on this vessel, home said, which was not reassuring. And then, in your quarters, I will only pay active attention to you when you speak to me directly, which was a little more so. Are you a person? Yes, said home. I am a ratified AI, registered with the Central Worlds, with a Chen level independent personality. I squinted up, trying to see a space where the voice might originate. Are you invisible? There was a sound that was not a sigh, but the suggestion of one, as if the speaker was too polite to be rude, but wished me to know of their uncommon forbearance. You might well say so. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to give offence. It's just that everything is strange. Even this room, I don't know what any of these things are. Well, Holmes said, sounding a little less ruffled, I can help with that.
Thank you.
That was Karen Healy, ending part one of the Word 2018 New Regent Street Pop-Up Festival on Science Fiction.